5. Free verse. When this verse was first dictated to me, I considered a monotonous cadence, like that used by Milton and Shakespeare and all writers of English blank verse, derived from the modern bondage of rhyming, to be a necessary and indispensable part of verse. But I soon found that in the mouth of a true orator, such monotony was not only awkward, but as much a bondage as rhyme itself. I therefore have produced a variety in every line, both of cadences and number of syllables. Every word and every letter is studied and put into its fit place. The terrific numbers are reserved for the terrific parts, the mild and gentle for the mild and gentle parts, and the prosaic for inferior parts. All are necessary to each other. Poetry fettered fetters the human race. William Blake, To the Public, Jerusalem. So much of the theory and the spirit that gave rise to the notion of free verse in the 20th century can be seen in this address by William Blake, 1757 to 1827, writing at the outset of the 19th. This chapter will explore the origins of what came to be known in the 20th century as free verse, and look at the many directions this approach to the poetic line has taken. As Blake acknowledges, poets have frequently chafed at the formal demands they inherit, which is why Shakespeare in his plays, and Milton in his epic poetry, derived their verse from rhyme and wrote blank verse. We have seen too in chapter 4 how measured verse regularizes the numbers of cadences and syllables, but that this regularity was not always strict in practice. But Blake finds their measures monotonous. He wants variety in every line, and it is the regulation of beat that becomes the later liberator's complaint against measured verse. When Ezra Pound, 1885 to 1972, joined the argument, he urged poets to compose in the sequence of the musical phrase, not in sequence of a metronome. Rhyme then should not be timed by a preset mechanism, but suit the demands of the individual poem, according to whether it is, as Blake writes, terrific or mild and gentle. Free verse and liberation. But the argument is not only technical, but also part of a wider claim to liberation. Blake's view of poetry is visionary, and for him, its true voice is the original voice of humankind. He states that his verse is dictated to him, not composed within the schemes of tradition. This pristine utterance of a true orator comes from divine inspiration and cannot be so confined. Indeed, those schemes are but another part of the chains of culture that bind the natural freedom that is our original state. Poetry fettered fetters the human race. Although two of its major influences in the 20th century, Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot, 1888 to 1965, shared nothing of this romantic temperament, poetic allegiance or philosophy of Blake's, there is a powerful part of the poetics of free verse which appeals to broader hopes of liberation. Let us, therefore, look at the modern evolution of free verse as both a formal and a cultural development. The biblical line. In respect of numbers, the biblical line might be described as free. These lines are from Psalm 136. O give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever. O give thanks unto the God of gods, for his mercy endureth forever. O give thanks to the Lord of lords, for his mercy endureth forever. To him who alone doth great wonders, for his mercy endureth forever. To him that by wisdom made the heavens, for his mercy endureth forever. The lines here are defined by what is to be said. Each has a variety of cadences and number of syllables, and is end-stopped. That is, the end of the line concludes with the end of the sentence. But they do feature other gestures to make the lines memorable, notably the recurrence at their opening, "O give thanks," "to him who," and their closing, "endureth forever," that rhetorical device of anaphora. The variations are built around these common elements. Blake's line in Jerusalem and elsewhere is inspired by biblical model, and sometimes employs similar recurrences. The land of darkness flamed, but no light and no repose. The land of snows of trembling and of iron hail incessant. The land of earthquakes and the land of woven labyrinths. The land of snares and traps and wheels and pitfalls and dire mills. Another earlier poet, Christopher Smart, 1722-71, in his Jubilee Agno, uses the style for his own distinctive devotional purposes. "For I will consider my cat Geoffrey, for he is the servant of the living God, duly and daily serving him, for at first glance of the glory of God in the east he worships, him in his way. For is this done by wreathing his body 7 times, round with elegant quickness? For then he leaps up to catch the musk, which is the blessing of God, upon his prayer." Smart is drawing upon the general manner of the verses in the Bible as set out in the Authorized Version of 1611, especially that of the Psalms and Song of Solomon, and the Magnificat of the Virgin Mary in chapter 1 of St. Luke's Gospel, from which he takes the iterative use of "for." Both Blake and Smart were in effect working outside the mainstream of verse style. The model of the biblical verse gave them the amplitude their imaginations demanded, but also a form closer to popular knowledge. After all, in the 18th century, the Bible was heard and read in churches, chapels, and homes daily and weekly, and would be far more widely familiar than the couplets of famous London poets of the period, such as Alexander Pope. We can see a familiar turn towards the biblical line in another poet, seeking to mark a poetic space distinct from the tradition, the American Walt Whitman, 1819-92. "Not a whisper comes out of him of the old stock talk, the rhyme of poetry, no breath of Europe." This is Whitman in an anonymous review of his own first book in 1855. The main marker of what Whitman called his language experiment is his shattering of measure. Again, we can see the influence of the biblical line, augmented apparently by translations he knew of the Hindu sacred texts of the Bhagavad Gita. He makes great use of anaphoric structures, series and enumerations, and exclamations and declamations, endless unfolding word of ages, but what he called his barbaric yawp is also capable of the most delicate detailing of image and rhythm in moments of quietude, such as this from Chant 6 of his huge poem, Song of Myself. "A child said, 'What is the grass?' fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer, designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name some way in the corners, that we may see the remark and say, whose? Guessing is characteristic of Whitman's style of intuition, by which a flower on his windowsill satisfies me more than the metaphysics of books. So the American colloquialism is a way of talking to the reader and suggesting a whole way of knowing. The use of the commonplace image of the dropped handkerchief in this mystical context is also part of Whitman's democratic voice. The placing of some way, too, is a matchless touch, as it particularizes the handkerchief that bit more, and lengthens the line in a way that suggests the slightly longer time taken to look at it. For all his use of formulae and the round oratory of his public manner, Whitman does flex this style of free line to the most various and often subtle and intimate uses. This passage from one of his war poems, "A Sight in the Daybreak, Grey and Dim," begins and nearly ends with a tetrameter, but in between he stretches the lines with the utmost tact. "Curious, I halt and silent stand. Then with light fingers I, from the face of the nearest, the first, just lift the blanket. Who are you, elderly man, so gaunt and grim, with well-grayed hair and flesh all sunken about the eyes? Who are you, my dear comrade?" The inversion, "silent stand," in the first line, establishes some formality, though he has admitted to simple curiosity. But then the tremulousness of his lifting the blanket is carried with those seemingly unnecessary, but in fact vital, extra syllables. The first, followed by the "just" of "just lift." Generally, Whitman makes his line coincide with the unit of sense, and hardly ever uses run-on lines. Often the longer lines do have some kind of caesura, but here he manages to articulate the whole slow length in order to mime the action described. The studied informality of Whitman's line is of a piece with his drawing his subject matter from the familiar scene of ferries, streets, and locomotives, and a diction happy to employ words like higgled, draggled, and soggy, alongside the more high-toned esculent, obstetric, gness, and sextillions. All of this comprises Whitman's radical and deliberately American revision of poetic norms and anticipates not only the work of his most obvious imitators, like Allen Ginsberg, 1926-98, but all the significant changes to poetry in the 20th century. The line of Gerard Manley Hopkins, 1844-89, is somewhat different, but bears a comparison with Whitman's. We noted in Chapter 4 how the iambic pentameter, with its equable alternations of unstressed and stressed syllables, can be seen as an imposition of educated sophistication. Hopkins wanted to return to the roughness and energy of medieval strong stress meters. Accordingly, he developed a measure called sprung rhythm, named for the way the line springs across a varying number of unstressed syllables from one strong stress to the next. He also disturbs the alternating decorum of standard lines by jamming stresses together, jagging the lines with stutters of punctuation as his matter demands. This is from one of his religious sonnets, "Carrion Comfort." "Not, I'll not, carrion comfort, despair, not feast on thee. Not untwist, slack they may be, these last strands of man. In me, or, most wary, cry, I can say no more. I can something, hope, wish day come, not choose not to be." Since the poem rhymes and uses the set form of the sonnet, it can hardly be called free verse. But the lines themselves entirely disrupt traditional measure with their staccato, gasping urgency, which Hopkins makes yet more emphatic by his extra marking of stress. In his journals, Hopkins writes, "You must not slovenly read it with your eyes, but with your ears, as if the paper were declaiming it at you. Stress is the life of it." Modernism and free verse. Hopkins's poetry was not published until 1918, by which time the modernist movement towards free verse was well underway. We have already glanced in chapter 4 at Ezra Pound's 1913 poem, The Seafarer, a poem described as from the Anglo-Saxon. Like Hopkins, he has sought out earlier less equable poetic manners to help him escape the inherited voice. Thus, the poem is syntactically jagged, consonantal, often alliterative, and set in irregular lines containing strong stresses, hung with hard ice flakes. "Where hail scur flew, there I heard naught save the harsh sea, and ice-cold wave, at wiles, and swan cries, did for my games and gannets clamour. Sea-fowl's loudness was for me laughter, and muse singing all my mead drink." Some knowledge of the Anglo-Saxon fragments would prevent a man's sinking into contentment with a lot of wish-wash that passes for classic or standard poetry, wrote Pound in a typically pugnacious essay. The sentiment that verse must be dragged from contentment, a lolling posture drafted by the zephyrs of familiar rhythms, liquid consonants, and mild assonants, pervades modernist poetics at this time. It goes along with disgust, with the complacent platform eloquence, the conventional oompa oompa, as one critic called it, of Edwardian public poetry in the years before the First World War. Pound, who wrote bitterly about the waste and misery of the war, wanted to make it new to avoid being gathered into the standard voice of the time. So he sought models not only in Anglo-Saxon, but also in Provençal, Italian, Chinese, and Japanese poetry. He put himself through a program of defamiliarization, aimed not just at making changes to his poetic line, but also to subject matter, and, as we have seen in Chapter 3, describing the use of persona to his tone of voice. Casting off, as it were, complete masks of the self in each poem. T.S. Eliot was engaged in the same process at the same time, and he found a decisive influence when, in 1906, he read the poems of Jules Laforgue, 1860 to 87. The phrase free verse translates the earlier French phrase vers libre, and French poetry, most obviously in the prose poems of Charles Baudelaire, 1821 to 67, and Arthur Rimbaud, 1854 to 91, had been seeking its own departures from the formal verse, especially from the dominant Alexandrine. Stéphane Mallarmé, 1842-98, wrote in 1891, "We are now witnessing a spectacle which is truly extraordinary, unique in the history of poetry. Every poet is going off by himself with his own flute and playing the songs he pleases. For the first time since the beginning of poetry, poets have stopped singing bass. Hitherto, if they wish to be accompanied, they had to be content with the great organ of official metre." Selected Prose Poems, Essays and Letters, 1956, page 18. In 1886, Laforgue described the direction his verse was taking in a letter. "I forget to rhyme. I forget the number of syllables. I forget to set it in stanzas. the lines themselves, begin in the margin just like prose. The old regular stanza only turns up when a popular quatrain is needed. I'll have a book like this ready when I come to Paris. I'm working on nothing else. This place is a dump, eating, smoking, 20 minutes in the bath to digest. And the rest of the time, what else can you do but write poetry? D. Arkell, Looking for La Forque, 1979, pages 196-7. I quote the circumstantial details here, since they suggest something of the mood between exasperation and lassitude that Eliot evidently responded to in La Forque, which colours the voices of decisive early poems, such as Portrait of a Lady and The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, in contrast to the anguish which rings Hopkins's line, or the bracing stridency of The Seafarer. La Forque cultivates the notion, though very knowingly, that he has fallen into vers libre as an idle accident. The speaker in Eliot's Portrait of a Lady doodles with the line as with the emotions. Look here at the varying lengths and listen for where you think the stresses fall. Doubtful for a while, not knowing what to feel or if I understand, or whether wise or foolish, tardy or too soon. Would she not have the advantage, after all? This music is successful, with a dying fall, now that we talk of dying, and should I have the right to smile? In fact, La Forgue did not forget to rhyme, though he did so irregularly, and Eliot follows suit. The whole final paragraph of Portrait of a Lady, from which the previous lines come, rhymes A B C D E C A F F G E. As we have already seen in Chapter 3, Eliot's idea of the line focuses on the contrast between fixity and flux. The flux, though, is crucial, for it embodies the casual and colloquial quality of voice that, as we saw in Chapter 3 on Tons of Voice, shook early 20th century poetry. In 1917, in an essay, Reflections on Contemporary Poetry, Eliot wrote, "One of the ways by which contemporary verse has tried to escape the rhetorical, the abstract, the moralizing, to recover, for that is its purpose, the accents of direct speech, is to concentrate its attention on trivial or accidental or commonplace objects." In Eliot's earlier work, the line registers personalities too unsure of themselves to be either certain or anguished. Idleness, however, has always been the accusation of traditionalists decrying free verse. If it could be associated with the supposed debility of foreigners, so much the better. The minimal line. The general movement of free verse, then, is towards a democratic informality that has a more flexible rhythm and a wider, more colloquial range of words. Once freed of measure, the line has gone in two main different directions. One has been towards minimalism, reduction, and the other towards expansiveness, spread. Poets who heard the full metrical line as umpa umpa have wanted to purge verse of elevation or pretense, to strip it down to the barest elements, highlighting words with semantic content, and minimize syntactic connection. The line, in consequence, tends to be short. We have already seen in Chapter 3 how William Carlos Williams finds a register for his nervous sensibility. "I didn't go in for long lines," and "very much an American kid," his own cultural situation. The lines he uses in poems like An Early Martyr and Pastoral are self-effacingly brief, and could be briefer, as in this conversation with his barber. Of death, the barber talked to me, cutting my life with sleep to trim my hair. It's just a moment, he said. We die every night. Williams, 1988. This poem eventually ends warmly, but this matter-of-fact opening is more discomforting for its terseness. This is not Williams at his most easygoing, as the opening inversion shows, of death, the barber, talked to me. Though the repetition is a recognizable exclamation of surprise. The line breaks also quietly disrupt expectations, not only of the metered line and the grammatical unit, but enable effects like the small shock of cutting my life. Overall, what these broken lines do is make the ordinary chat of someone passing the time of day with his barber extraordinary. They wield cheers, but hairdressers don't often draw our attention to death. Like many of Williams's poems, its casual, jotted manner belies the penetration of his glance at the mundane. In poems like these, the visual element is important too. Isolated on a full page, the poem has a concentrated look, as though distilled into the whiteness. Here is the strong visual dimension of the poem's deliberate space. Williams has testified to the part played by the introduction of the typewriter into the compositional process. Its brisk mechanical motion and the even impress of the ink promote a sense of simple fixity and of the poem as a physical object. We sometimes speak of setting down words. This has the sense of writing as something simple and fixed. In his long autobiography, Brig Flats, the English poet Basil Bunting, 1900-85, finds his ideal in an anthology with stone cutting. The mason stirs, words, pens are too light, take a chisel to write. Bunting's advice to an aspiring poet is to put away your poem until you forget it, and then cut out every word you dare, and then repeat this process again and again. In this way, Bunting believed, the poem, properly reduced to its impressive essentials, would become absolutely clear. A very similar ideal of clarity can be seen in a poet who takes the Williams manner into a different scene, Gary Schneider, 1930 to date. Like Bunting, their common aesthetic goal is to approximate the physical world as directly as possible onto the page, and to attend to sense and impression rather than thought. Schneider, a pastoral poet of the North American wilderness, likens the poem to a riprap, a mountain path laid in single stones. Lay down these words, before your mind like rocks, placed solid by hands. The lines have a set, bitten-off quality. This is the opening of Schneider's Mid-August at Sourdough Mountain Lookout. Down valley a smoke haze, 3 days heat after 5 days rain. Pitch glows on the fir cones, across rocks and meadows. Swarms of new flies. Written of Williams, Kenneth Burke wrote, the process is simply this. There is the eye, and there is the thing upon which that eye alights, while the relationship existing between the two is a poem. This aesthetic normally finds its voice, or image, in the spare minimalist short line. It is also an aesthetic which, in the modernist manner, aims for a depersonalized voice. One that allows only the minimum intervention of conscious thought or emotional response. Writing of Williams, another great American poet, Wallace Stevens, 1879-1955, puts it like this. What Williams gives, on the whole, is not sentiment, but the reaction from sentiment, or rather, a little sentiment, very little, together with acute reaction. Williams, says Stevens, has a sentimental side, but continuously reacts against it. This is of a piece with his passion for the anti-poetic, a passion shared by many of the poets who, like Schneider, embraced Williams's poetics, and especially the guarded austerity of the short, free line. It is a guardedness with respect to the I as original poet, composer, or artist, sole origin of the artwork, that found its extreme manifestation in found or ready-made works of art, such as Marcel Duchamp's Urinal, signed R. Mutt, offered for exhibition in New York in 1917, and rejected. However, such a line is not bound to such a relaxed tone, nor does it necessarily muffle its speaking voice. The Welsh poet R.S. Thomas, 1913-2000, often uses a similar line, sometimes in an equally impersonal way, and with some of Schneider's stone-laying quality, if with a different, more imposing tone. But in Welsh, Thomas uses the same line for a very distinctly characterized voice. Why must I write so? I'm Welsh, see. A real Cymro. Peat in my veins. I was born late. She claimed me. Brought me up nice. No hardship. Only the one loss. I can't speak my own language. Of course, this sounds much different from American colloquialism. But the spare line fits this grim, resentful shortness with words. Expansiveness and field composition. The other stream of writing encouraged by the freeing of the line is expansive. Following Whitman, the poem can be deliberately, often ostentatiously casual, keen to amble through the everyday bombardment of impressions without feeling any pressure to arrive at significance. The line is simply and suitably longer. Here is Frank O'Hara, 1926-66, afoot with his own kind of vision in the beginnings of some almost randomly chosen poems. Ah, nuts. It's boring reading French newspapers in New York, as if I were a colonial waiting for my gin. The spent purpose of a perfectly marvelous life suddenly glimmers and leaps into flame. I'm getting tired of not wearing underwear, and then again I like it, strolling along, feeling the wind blow softly on my genitals. Totally abashed and smiling, I walk in and face the frigidaire. Light clarity avocado salad in the morning. After all the terrible things I do, how amazing it is to find forgiveness in love. References to literature, art, music, and the writing of poems abound in O'Hara's work, but the subtext of these lines, like many of his openings, is "This is not a poem." He shares the modernist fear of the pretentiously poetic, but rather than trying to pare it away, he seeks to bury it by being talkative and exuberant. Strong feelings, often in gusts, frequently lies at the heart of his poems. But it comes unexpected, surrounded by the trivial, so that its true surprise is maintained. Light clarity, avocado salad in the morning, the terrible things I do, camouflage big words like forgiveness and love. And that abrupt line turn, how amazing it is to find, arrests us before we have seen them coming. Because it denies itself a formal stance, the democratically colloquial register of modern free verse is always wrestling with the issue of how to phrase something really serious. It both wants to be part of the daily flow of everyday language and to be marked off from it. The poem Beginning, are nuts. Les Luth is a love poem and at heart feels the traditional pains of love. Everybody here is running around after dull pleasantries and wondering if the Hotel Wentley poems is as great as I say it is, and I am feeling particularly testy at being separated from the one I love by the most dreary of practical exigencies, money, when I want only to lean on my elbow and stare into space, feeling the one warm, beautiful thing in the world, breathing upon my right rib. The run-on lines here go to the extreme of cutting into the syntax, but in a way that does not disorient the reader as much as emphasize the speaker's impatience. The rhythm slows, though, over that hint at self-mockery in particularly testy and the most dreary of practical exigencies. Both are cleverly cumbersome prosy phrases, between which, almost by the way, comes the crucial emotional phrase, itself a consciously recognized cliché, the one I love. The lover's sweet pain is then drawn out in that last line, with its series of firm stresses and a breath-catching caesura. The one warm, beautiful thing in the world, breathing upon my right rib. Free verse, of course, does not do away with rhythm. What it does do is bring in the opportunity for a very peculiar, intuitive variation, Blake's variety in every line. For all the apparent self-effacement that goes with modernist free verse, whether by clipping the voice or by having it speak from within a spinning cloud of scenes, impressions, and knowingness, idiosyncrasy is at the heart of it. The essential point of the unmeasured line is that it is particular to its occasion, bespoke, not already patterned. Charles Olson, 1910-70, in his influential essay, Projective Verse, 1950, insists that when a poet departs from closed form, he puts himself in the open. He can go by no track other than the one the poem underhand declares for itself. In effect, Olson is developing the romantic tradition in which Coleridge formulated the idea of organic form. This means, as Olson's countryman, Ralph Waldo Emerson, put it in the 19th century, that a poem is not an artifact, but, like the spirit of a plant or an animal, it has an architecture of its own. These ideas will be considered more fully in Chapter 8. Imagine, imagination, and inspiring. Olson's aim is the entire abandonment of what he derided as the honey head, the sweetness of meter and rhyme, in favour of a line based on the breathing rhythms of the poet. As for Williams, the typewriter becomes important since its precise calibrations enable the composing poet to score the poem not only with conventional punctuation, but also by exact spacing, multiple margins, and symbols such as the forward slash. This field composition can thus configure a poem across the full dimensions of the page. This is from Olson's poem, The Distances. Death is a loving matter, then a horror we cannot abide, and avoid by greedy life. We think all living things are precious. Pygmalions, a German inventor in Key West who had a Cuban girl and kept her after her death in his bed. After her family retrieved her, he stole the body again from the vault. There is a concrete effect here in the use of the space on the page. But Olson's aim is more radical yet. He is trying to break, or at least stretch, the conventions of grammar and syntax in, as he puts it himself, the attack, I suppose, on the completed thought, or the idea, yes? Sentences may have deferred, or no full stops, parentheses may be opened, but not necessarily closed.
in order to simulate the processes of uncompleted thought, perhaps the peculiar individuality of consciousness itself. In projective verse, Olson understandably shies away from an analysis of how far a new poet can stretch the very conventions on which communication by language rests. In the quest for liberation, free verse, as we have seen, has always sought connection with the naturalness of speech. The early on free verse, in the Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics, describes it like this.
All poetry reconstructs direct experience by means of devices of equivalence. All poetry has attributes of a naturalizing and an artificializing rhetoric. However, more explicitly than metrical poetry, free verse claims and thematizes a proximity to lived experience. It does this by trying to replicate, project, or represent perceptual, cognitive, emotional, and imaginative processes. Lived experience and replicated process are unreachable goals, but nevertheless, this ethos is what continues to draw writers and readers to free verse. But why imitate speech? Asked the American poet Robert Grenier, 1941 to date, in 1971.
I hate speech, he continues.
He does so because he sees the injunction to follow the spoken word as but another constraint upon the poet. Moreover, since we have less awareness of the impositions of speech patterns, he argues that they form a constraint less obvious, and so more confining than, say, an iambic pentameter. Grenier asks another, yet more radical question. Where are the words most themselves? I suspect it's impossible to answer. To ask it implies a utopian longing. Classical rhetoric and poetics asserted that words are most themselves when fashioned to best effect. The romantic reaction, which remains dominant in our own day, privileges natural speech as the pristine source for poetry. For Grenier, in a cadence reminiscent of Whitman,
it isn't the spoken any more than the written. The words of the poem are words occurring, whether they hail from the written, the spoken, the dreamt, or wherever else.
Following Grenier, we might well ask, do we need more ordinary speech, or touched up ordinary speech, as poetry can often be? Poetry that is, in James Fenton's 1949 to date, witty characterization, strictly free, can be as cliched as a leaden sonnet. But as a poet seeks rhythms that are truly surprising, she or he will sense when the sequence of words is falling into the easy arms of the reader's expectation, whether that be a dull metric or a worn colloquialism. But the background noise of rhythmical, as of all other linguistic cliché that surrounds the poet's ear, is now more prolific than ever. It inhabits what we call information. To be free in verse is to be heard beyond that blurry, familiar noise, to be distinct. But the words most themselves are not waiting somewhere else for us to find them, but are in the midst, part of the storm. The poetic line has to be tuned from the clamour. Here is Geoffrey Hill, 1932 to 2016, discomfited, not now being able to take as fact even my own dyings forcing his way, head down, towards a description of what he might know in part 110 of his speech. Speech. What I see here are unfixable fell gusts, ratching, the cranky chimney cowls, their smokes blown, hard down or tagged ragged, shade and shine, the chapel wind vanes blistery fake gold, I imagine. You see this also, such, is the flare through memory of desire. Summary. In this chapter on free verse, we have considered the origins of free verse, its associations with ideas of liberation, the variations of the biblical verse line, modernism and free verse, the use of free verse as a feature of a democratic informal style, minimal and expansionist styles, the opening of the page towards field composition, whether poetry should be close to speech.